at your disposal, just like I did. If things get dirty with the GSC and our country is in trouble, you'll always have the nuclear option of telling everyone what really happened. You'll always have the nuclear option of capital F, capital D. Full disclosure. I would do it myself, but I'm not convinced they would let me, and I'm not convinced anyone would believe me, no matter how much evidence I presented. Dan didn't say anything. He knew that full disclosure was decisively off the table, and he certainly didn't need to ask who Walker meant by they. As Rooster lay down again, Walker opened the door. "I have nothing to apologize for," he said, placing a large but frail hand on Dan's shoulder. "But just remember, when the time comes, neither do you." C-57. Drive-in, Birchwood, Colorado. "He knew the rules," Phil Norris insisted, ignoring Mr. Bird's attempts to soften his position regarding Clark's recently revoked meal card. "I don't care how much he's done for this place, he knew the rules and he chose to break them." Mr. Bird, always softly spoken, sighed lightly. "Come on, Phil. It's not like he was taking extra food to sell it or even to stash it at home. He was trying to give some food to a bum." "Phil was right to take the card," Henry McCarthy interjected, sick of listening to an argument that was going nowhere so late in the night. "Clark did know the rules. All I'll say is that from experience, I think keeping hold of it for a few days will be long enough to make the point. He might not be as book smart as Dan, but he's better at learning lessons. If it were me, I'd give him back the card sometime next week." Phil and Mr. Bird both appeared to see merit in Henry's middle ground, and nothing else on the subject was said. "And speaking of me being right," Phil said with a gloating chuckle, pointing towards the TV as an ad ran for the following night's Focus 2020 panel. "See that, Henry boy? There you were on Wednesday night telling me that Emma wouldn't get involved in any of this. What was it you said? Any more of the media crap. And here we are 3 days later and she's in New York with Timo Fiore. You can take the girl out of the business, but you can't take the business out of the girl." Mr. Bird, who felt that he knew Emma a lot better than Phil did, shook his head slowly. "She's helping Timo out. That's all." "Exactly," Henry said. "No one in Birchwood except you and your bank manager wants any more media bullshit, Norris. Emma's not doing this as a publicity thing, and even if she has to put herself in front of a camera once or twice, there's no way the boys are going to get sucked into any of that. So yeah, you're about as right as you usually are, i.e., wrong." Phil watched the end of the ad, taking in a lineup which included Timo, William Godfrey, Joe Crabb, and Billy Kendrick, all highly familiar faces from Dan's highly public misadventures of the previous year. "We'll see," was all he said. "We'll see." C-56. Gravison Hotel, Manhattan, New York. In the small hours of the night, Emma sat on the edge of her plush bed in one of the New York Gravison's most expensive suites. Timo, footing the bill for both this suite and his own, had called it a night several hours earlier, after an intensive research and prep session ahead of his high-pressure appearance on Focus 2020 the next day, but Emma still had several more working hours ahead of her. Every now and again she took a break from analyzing recent comments from the rest of the panel's lineup and looked down at the cold streets she didn't miss, where she had spent many busy years, working at the XPR agency founded by her former mentor, Jack Neal. Jack was set to be among Timo's fellow panelists, as the frequent TV ads and giant billboard displays made sure everyone knew. Emma and Timo passed two digital billboards advertising the show on their way to the hotel, and analysts were already predicting that this upcoming episode of Focus 2020 would draw viewing figures only previously seen by the record-breaking episode immediately preceding the UN meeting, which led to the GSC's creation a year earlier. Recent events, chiefly the Kerguelen bolide and Timo's announcement of his plans to unilaterally break the GSC's worldwide monopoly on space-based research, made the network's pre-announced decision to have a GSC-themed episode look extremely timely. And the makeup of the upcoming panel bore more than a passing resemblance to the record-breaker of the previous year, with five of the six participants returning. Joe Crabb, Jack Neal, and William Godfrey would all be in the studio once again, while Timo Fiori would this time be present in person, and Billy Kendrick would appear live via satellite, as Timo had last time out. Only newspaper editor Jan Geller had not been invited to return. This was primarily because she was no longer personally relevant, which she had been during the coverage of the IDA leak, but it was also in part due to her frequent hawking of The Daily Chat and other Blitz media properties while appearing on the rival network which broadcast Focus 2020. Every time Emma looked out at the lights of Manhattan, the only place she wanted to be was Birchwood. A giant cosmetics ad featuring none other than her sister Tara was visible from one part of the corner suite's huge window-like wall, and this only made the longing stronger. Despite their differences, Emma liked to see Tara doing well, but that didn't change the fact that she wasn't overly comfortable leaving her next door to Dan, particularly given his indefensible decision to pull the rug out from under Emma and Clark's feet by going against everything that they had agreed and unilaterally deciding to bring Timo in on the secret. It didn't matter that Timo's response had been just about as positive as it could have been. What mattered was that Dan had betrayed her trust, not merely by telling Timo, but by telling him at a time that left her with nowhere to go and no option but to play hardball with the richest man in the world. And while Dan saw Timo as a fun guy to be around, Emma understood that with money came power, and just as pertinently that anyone as willing as Timo was to stand toe-to-toe with the might of William Godfrey's GSC was not someone to be taken lightly. Fortunately, her carrot-and-stick approach seemed to have worked, and her decision to promise Timo the full details only once he made it through Focus 2020 without saying the wrong thing certainly appeared to have won his cooperation. Like her, Timo was now aching to get back to Colorado, so much so that he had already made arrangements to squeeze his Italian media engagements into a single day and night to enable the promptest possible return. But while Timo eagerly wanted to get back to candidly discussing everything with Dan, who he believed must have had a very good reason to keep quiet about the hoax for so long, Emma's current view of Dan was somewhat less favorable, to say the least. She similarly knew that Dan must have had a very good and very specific reason to tell Timo when he did, presumably related to his vague, "He's the only one who can help us" comment, but nothing could excuse the way he had gone about doing it. She could only imagine that Clark's anger was similar to her own, even though he hadn't been the one left in the firing line aboard Timo's private jet when Dan handed over his handwritten note and ran away before its impact was felt. Emma's phone told her that Dan had tried to call twice, no doubt with a too little too late apology at the ready, but her decision to remove him from the virtual receptionist's all-hours whitelist ensured that he would have to hold on to it until she was back in Birchwood. Both her focus and Timo's had repeatedly been tempted to drift elsewhere throughout the evening, but Emma knew that anything other than full concentration on the next day's showdown with two of the slickest and slimiest men in politics, William Godfrey and Jack Neal, could only end one way. For now, they were the focus. For now, Dan and Tara could wait. C-minus 55. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. Dan's feet were too cold to feel any of the stones and twigs he'd stood on during his long walk home from Stevenson Farm, and all he wanted to do was get inside and warm them up in the bath. If anyone had seen him on his way to the cornfield, his dazed-like demeanor would have doubtless led them to think he was sleepwalking, just as Emma and Clark had naturally assumed when he first entered the same kind of trance-like state a year earlier. On his way back from the cornfield, Dan's full consciousness enabled him to all but eliminate the chance that anyone would see him now by staying away from the main road. And despite his numb feet and the awkward run-in with Richard Walker, Dan walked the long way home with a smile on his face. At last, he absolutely, positively knew that the messengers were close. And more than that, he absolutely, positively knew that they weren't finished with him. As soon as he got home and could feel his feet again, he'd have some game-changing new leads to follow. Star maps and moon phases would be his first ports of call in his bid to make sense of the triangle in the sky. Although there was a long way to go before everything was clear, Dan already felt like his faith and confidence in the messengers had been vindicated. Kerguelen was an attention-grabbing message to the world. There was no denying that. But this personal call to a fresh crop circle in the familiar cornfield where it all began, and more importantly, the vivid, if unstraightforward, message that followed, had been delivered solely to Dan. Whatever understandable doubts Clark and Emma might have had, and whatever unanswered questions were rattling through Dan's own mind, he now knew this much. The messengers were talking to him. Absolutely, positively. But as Dan entered the final and shortest stage of his journey, approaching his house slowly and with great care to be quiet and avoid activating any security lights, a slow but bright flash caught his eyes. It was coming from next door.
"Dan McCarthy,"
a chirpy voice called. He looked over and saw Tara standing at Emma's front door, slowly covering and uncovering her phone's flashlight. She put the phone in her pocket and took a few steps towards him.
"You know, Dan, I wouldn't keep catching you sneaking around in the middle of the night like this if you didn't keep sneaking around in the middle of the night like this."
"I wasn't sneaking," he said.
"Seriously, though, where have you been? I checked the cameras when I woke up an hour ago because I'm not used to being on my own like this, and I don't exactly like living in an empty house with a dirt path and creepy woods right behind it." The cameras had picked up a few incidents. There was one of your dad getting home from the bar about an hour ago, and before that there was another one triggered by you, walking back there by yourself. Then I tried calling you, but you weren't picking up your phone.
"It's inside," Dan said, relieved that his home's security console was now located in the basement rather than the kitchen, and hence that Henry wouldn't be alerted to any suspicious incidents like Tara had been. There was no doubt that Henry would be sleeping by now, a full hour after getting home so late, so Dan felt extremely lucky that the timing had worked out fortuitously enough to ensure that their paths didn't cross.
"Why would you go out without your phone? Do you even have a flashlight?"
The darkness and his empty hands answered for him, leaving Dan stumped as to what he could say to get out of this. "I just needed some air," he eventually said. Tara pointed to his house.
"What's wrong with your back door? Or your front door?"
"I just needed some thinking space."
"It's no quieter back there than it is in your backyard."
"I needed thinking space," Dan said, "not just quiet."
"What were you thinking about? All the Kerguelen stuff or personal stuff? The thing with Emma last night?"
"There's a lot going on at once," he replied noncommittally. "I just needed a break, and right now I feel like I just need some sleep, so I'm going to go to bed. I'll see you later."
"Well, I'm here whenever you need to talk, okay?"
Tara said, sounding very genuine and perhaps slightly concerned. As with the last time Dan had spoken to her late at night, her natural accent was quite noticeable and sounded very much like Emma's, if a little higher pitched.
"I guess I'll see you tomorrow?"
"Maybe," Dan said. He then stepped towards his door as soon as Tara returned inside. His first step, just one more step, was enough to engage the security light above the door. Illuminated by the bright lamp, Dan glanced down at his bare feet and the various dirt marks the cornfield had left on his trouser legs. If he had taken this single extra step either just before or just after Tara announced her presence, she would have seen it all and asked questions too difficult to dodge. The field of view of Emma's side-facing security camera didn't quite reach this far, and that only made the lucky escape even more fortunate. "That was close," Dan thought as he headed inside to warm himself up and reflect on an incredible few hours. Too close. Sunday. C-minus 54. RMXT Studio Number 1, Manhattan, New York. In a labyrinthine studio complex whose corridors she had walked only too many times in the past, Emma fastidiously ran through her key points from the previous night's prep work and made sure that Timo knew how to deal with anything that might come up during his imminent high-pressure appearance on Focus 2020. They had nothing to worry about from longtime ally Billy Kendrick's appearance via satellite, while shock jock Joe Crabb wasn't taken seriously enough by anyone to pose any kind of meaningful threat. Almost everything Emma and Timo discussed related to the complex relationship between GSC Chairman William Godfrey and Prime Minister John Cole, the man who once served as his deputy. Cole himself wouldn't be on the panel, of course, and would instead be represented by the proxy of his senior advisor Jack Neal, who both Emma and Godfrey knew only too well. There was no love lost between any of them, but Emma repeated herself several times in telling Timo that his priority was making sure that Jack didn't manage to link Cole to Timo in an effort to leech some of his public goodwill. Emma knew that Jack would sycophantically fawn over Timo's recently announced ambitions to develop new space-related technologies via his Fiori Frontieri program, and she drove the same point home over and over again until she felt sure that Timo understood that any association with Jack, and by extension Cole, would prove toxic in the long run. Timo admitted to having paid little attention to British politics during Cole's first year as Prime Minister, but even he knew very well that Cole certainly wasn't without his detractors at home, with critics ranging from traditionalists within his own party to all manner of outsiders. One senior party figure, speaking for many, had even publicly commented that Chairman Godfrey's otherwise stellar legacy would be forever stained by his decision to handpick a successor who isn't fit to be the chairman of a county darts league. Indeed, some had gone so far as to posit that Godfrey picked a bad successor on purpose in order to make it easy for him to reclaim the party leadership when his GSC term limit expired. Although Godfrey himself said very little about Cole as an individual, he also made no secret of his intention to return to domestic politics when the time came. And since anyone with a pulse understood perfectly well that a leadership challenge from a returning William Godfrey was not one that John Cole could hope to survive, unless Godfrey's name and image were irredeemably tarnished in the meantime, it had come as little surprise to anyone that Cole had seemingly gone out of his way on several occasions to make Godfrey's life as difficult as he could. The only personal comment Godfrey let slip was his view that John Cole and Jack Neal were a match made in heaven, and even then he left everything else to subtext. What wasn't publicly known was that Godfrey remained personally affronted by Jack's snake-like decision to renege on a handshake agreement that he would never work with Cole after leaving Godfrey's side. Emma knew that Godfrey would be biting his tongue in an effort not to snap at Jack during the panel, and that Jack would likely be doing everything he could to bait him. The instruction to Timo was simple. Stay out of it. In the other direction, Cole still bore an intense grudge over something that had happened in China on the night of DS-1's ill-fated launch. It had been bad enough that Godfrey chose to pose with President Slater and Chinese Premier Ding Xiang with Cole watching from the sidelines, but the second snub cut Cole even deeper. This snub had come when Godfrey sent Cole to conduct an interview with some of the attendant press, only for Jack to later reveal that Godfrey had asked him to make sure the press weren't recording and wouldn't share any of Cole's words. Knowing that Godfrey had considered him a liability was all the motivation John Cole would ever need. What Emma made clear to Timo was that Godfrey's behavior and political tactics, while often distasteful, were consistent with an age-old power-for-its-own-sake philosophy and tended to stay within certain loosely defined bounds of acceptability. Cole, meanwhile, thrived on chaos. Emma used the metaphor of Godfrey being a particularly venomous snake and Cole being a particularly virulent pathogen. Both were dangerous, but the latter's behavior was altogether less predictable. With Jack Neal present in New York as nothing more than a mouthpiece for Cole, a wariness of their bull-in-a-china-shop approach was crucial to Timo's hopes of surviving the night untainted and unscathed. Timo, for his part, had impressed Emma throughout the day by remaining focused on the advice she gave him and making no mention of the blockbuster secret Dan had shared with him regarding Richard Walker's hoax. Like a character actor getting deep into a role, Timo seemed to recognize that consistently acting like nothing had changed was the only way he could make it through the panel without saying the wrong thing by mistake. As Emma was about to skirt that rule by, quickly checking that Timo still felt okay about staying quiet, the voice of a young studio intern called through the door after three quick knocks. Miss Ford?
1 second, Emma said to Timo. She opened the door.
Yeah? The intern gulped and blinked several times. He didn't look overly intimidated by Emma's presence. She knew that look well, and this wasn't it. But he was clearly uncomfortable with whatever he was about to say.
Spit it out, she said.
The intern nodded quickly as if trying to shake away his hesitation. He then spoke just as quickly.
Chairman Godfrey asked me to give you a message. He told me to say that you're on the wrong side, but that he won't hold it against you as long as you play by the rules.
Emma turned to Timo.
I'll be back in a minute.
The same young intern again knocked on the door of an occupied room within RMXT's Manhattan studio complex. This time, however, the panelist on the other side was William Godfrey.
I have a message for Chairman Godfrey, the intern said when someone else opened the door.
Godfrey's voice replied, increasing in volume as he moved towards the door.
What did she say?
The intern glanced uneasily at something out of Godfrey's view, prompting the GSC Supremo to step out of the room to see what he was looking at. Immediately, Godfrey recoiled very slightly in instinctive surprise at the unexpected sight of Emma Ford. Though his eyes were still and focused on hers, his facial muscles moved in the subtle way a trained observer like Emma recognized as telltale signs of being unpleasantly surprised.
Well, if it isn't Emma Ford, Godfrey eventually began, what brings you?
While shaking her head, Emma raised a single finger in the air between them. She counted the longest five count of her life, ignoring the triple quick heartbeat thumping in her chest, and then lowered the finger. Godfrey stayed quiet, somewhere between amused and confused. Emma inhaled deeply and shook away her lingering doubts.
The next time you feel like threatening me, she said very firmly, at least have the balls to say it to my face.
At that, she walked away.
Wait, Godfrey called after her. She ignored it. Emma, please.
This gave her pause. A please from William Godfrey was rare indeed.
What? She asked, stopping in her tracks but not yet turning around.
There's something I want you to see. I promise it'll take no more than a minute.
When Emma finally turned to face him, Godfrey curtly dismissed the lingering intern with a decisive hand gesture before beckoning Emma towards his room. Curiosity carried her to the door.
This better be quick.
Oh, it will be,
Godfrey said. He then opened the door, revealing several stunned faces all staring at Emma. She looked around the room, taking in the countless tablets, laptops, and printed charts on every surface and in almost every hand. She heard the last voices dying down towards the back of the room as the hush filtered its way across. Her eyes continued to dart around, looking for something meaningful in this beehive-like room full of aides.
12 Emma Fords, Godfrey said, each as disposable as the last, each as self-important as the next.
Some of his aides looked to the floor. Some looked at each other, and some pretended to keep working on whatever they'd been looking at before Emma arrived. None were as uncomfortable or embarrassed as Emma.
You think you're so special, Godfrey said, addressing Emma directly but still speaking loudly through the wide-open door.
He waited for her to look at him. When she eventually and reluctantly did, he shook his head.
Dan is special,
he continued, his words now positively dripping with derision.
You were just the first shark who smelled his blood.
Emma felt her face reddening. There was anger, there was embarrassment, and there was a swirling combination of the two, far more potent than the sum of its parts. Godfrey's eyebrows seemed to rise halfway up his forehead as he tilted his head back and dismissively flicked his hand outwards, as he'd done to the nameless intern moments earlier.
You can go now, he said.
Rendered speechless, Emma put all of her effort in trying to make sure that her expression didn't reflect her feelings.
Oh, and here's a little piece of advice for the road,
Godfrey added, leaning in close.
Don't start fights you can't win.
Godfrey then closed the door, leaving Emma stunned and alone in the corridor, wondering what had just happened. She closed her eyes for a few seconds, which proved long enough for the embarrassment to fade and anger to take over completely. At first, there was an element of anger at herself for playing into his hands by walking back when he called her, but this was nothing compared to her all-consuming rage directed squarely at Godfrey himself. When she arrived back at Timo's dressing room, he asked the obvious question. What did he want? Change of plan, Emma said. Godfrey wants a war, and that's exactly what he's going to get. C-53. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. Feeling a mixture of trepidation and excitement, Dan sat down on the couch next to his father's wheelchair in preparation for the big Focus 2020 panel. Clark was still nowhere to be seen after a full day doing overtime at the precinct, if the story he told Henry was true. He had been gone when Dan first went upstairs in the morning, and hadn't so much as called since then, so he knew nothing yet of Dan's unplanned excursion to Richard Walker's cornfield. Emma had way too much going on for Dan to try calling her before the show, and since she hadn't taken any of his calls the previous day, he didn't think she would have been in much of a mood to talk to him anyway. Throughout the day so far, as well as during several sleepless hours after returning home from Walker's place, Dan had been working frenetically in his basement, invigorated by his new information, and even more so by the overnight reaffirmation that the messengers really were close. Although none of Dan's new and speculative leads were yet firm enough to act on, he no longer felt a crushing mix of helplessness and impatience in his chest. The messengers had indirectly but overtly communicated with him the previous night, and he had every faith that they would do so again extremely soon. This wasn't to say he was prepared to rest on his laurels, however, and even as he sat down next to Henry, he was thinking about his next research moves. Momentary fear had struck him on a few occasions during the day, always concerning whether or not Timo would be able to make it through the panel without letting any of his new knowledge slip. Dan had no doubts at all that Timo would be trying to keep the secret to himself. Emma's powers of persuasion were never in question, but he understood that there was an inherent risk in having brought Timo in on the full truth when he did, right before Timo was about to appear on live TV and spar with some hostile fellow panelists. Dan thought back to how he had felt prior to his own ill-fated appearance on Marco Magnifico's live hypnosis show, when he was desperate to keep the existence of Hans Kloster's explosive handwritten letter to himself for a few more hours. He had succeeded in the end on that occasion, largely thanks to Emma and Mr. Bird, but he was under no illusions that keeping quiet about a partially translated letter was in the same league as keeping quiet about a world-changing truth like the one Timo now knew. Despite these thoughts, Dan didn't regret his action for a second. He regretted the way it had to go down, and particularly the difficulties it had caused for Emma, but he had felt and still felt that he simply had to bring Timo in. And since it naturally wouldn't have been safe to do so over the phone or via any other electronic method of communication, the one-off opportunity of a face-to-face handover of a short written explanation was literally too good to miss.
2020 ain't what it used to be, Henry mused in the moments before the show began. Even when it's something big like this, it's all politicians. Back in the day, they had athletes, movie stars, you name it.
Caitlin Judd was on the panel when I appeared via satellite, Dan said. Henry shrugged.
The exception that proves the rule. You know what I mean. I think I've just gotten old enough to see through the posturing and sound bites. You know, I wish I'd been here last year when you were going through everything. But one thing I'm glad I missed living through in real time was all the political crap that went along with the leak.
I get that, but this is totally different, Dan replied.
Last time the political posturing took weeks and it came in dribs and drabs. This time the main players are all sitting in the same room at the same time and getting ready to fight for position in a no-holds-barred 40-minute slugfest. This is huge.
Short of telling Henry what was going on behind the very curtain which Dan had endured such pains to keep in place, there was no surefire way of stressing just how important the next 40 minutes could be. This, as well as Henry's comments about not having lived through the IDA leak as it happened, sharpened Dan's focus as to why the curtain had to stay between them. The trio of Dan, Clark, and Emma had gone through it all together, living each revelation and counter-revelation in real time, an experience no one else could ever understand. They had stood together in turmoil in the kitchen when Richard Walker's now dead assistant arrived in the middle of the night to reveal that the supposed cover-up was in fact a lie, dressed up as a secret by way of an unbelievably intricate hoax. They had stood together in awe in Lolo National Forest as the real messengers arrived to make the lie come true. And they had stood together in the old drive-in lot to draw a line under the whole thing in front of the media's cameras. No one could ever understand what they had gone through together. Not even Henry. Aside from that stood Dan's second consideration. When they had learned it was a hoax, it was more than hard enough for any of them to take. But for Henry, it would be a heart-wrenching double whammy to learn that not only had Richard Walker lied to the world, but that his own sons had known this for a year and had been lying to him about it ever since. Allied to this, one of Henry's mottos had always been, "Don't drag other people into your problems." And given that sharing the secret with Henry would achieve nothing except easing Dan's conscience and driving the family apart, he had no intention of ever doing so. Making the secret public would be bad for the world, as Dan and the others understood very well, but it would be positively crushing for Henry McCarthy. As the long-running Sunday evening show's entrance music began, still marked in the recesses of Dan's mind as the unwelcome soundtrack to the end of his weekend and an imminent return to school, he settled comfortably in his seat. All he wanted was to see Timo make it through unscathed. As far as Dan knew, the next 40 minutes provided an opportunity to lose a lot and gain very little, so a non-event would do him just fine. What he didn't know was that Emma had very different plans. C-52 RMXT Studio Number 1, Manhattan, New York.
"Welcome, everyone, to a very special edition of Focus 2020, said Marion DeClercq, the show's long-running and universally respected host. "As I'm sure you're aware, today's show is as live can be, coming at you from the heart of New York City. Now, let's get right to business and meet our esteemed panel."
Timo Fiori, first to fall under the camera's focus, gave the simplest introductory remark of all. "Hello, everybody." Jack Neal gave a half nod when his turn came next, looking fairly disinterested.
"Thanks for having me back, Marion. We have a lot to cover, so I'll join my esteemed friend Timo in wasting none of our time on smart introductory remarks. All I'll say is that I'm here in a personal, quote-unquote unofficial capacity. I'm not here to speak on anyone else's behalf."
"I'm not your friend," Timo said, speaking out of turn. He took the resultant rebuke from DeClercq on the chin, having listened carefully to Emma's advice and thus understanding that he couldn't let Jack get away with any comments like that.
"Well, I am Timo's friend, and I'm extremely happy to be there in spirit via satellite."
Billy Kendrick smiled from a giant screen on the wall of the studio, visible to everyone on the panel.
"Truth be told, I'm happy to be anywhere other than the room on Kerguelen where Godfrey's GSC goons illegally held me against my will for several hours with no food and no phone call. But in any case, thanks for having me, Marion. It's always a pleasure."
Unsurprisingly, William Godfrey's opening remarks ignored Billy altogether and were instead a direct and undisguised jab at Jack Neal.
"It's a shame that Prime Minister Cole has sent Jack to do his bidding," he said. "Much as President Slater did a year ago on this very show, I certainly hope, for the sake of the viewers, that Jack is better prepared on this occasion and won't wilt like a daisy in the desert as he did last time."
Godfrey had been around for long enough to know that politics had been more spectacle than substance for decades, but it often irked him that the spectacle had now morphed into little more than a mosaic of attention-catching soundbites. His philosophy had always been simple, however. Whatever the game was and however he had to play it, he was there to win. Joe Crabb, last in the line, then grunted his introductory remarks at no one in particular.
"Like DeClercq said, we're in New York City.
We're doing a show for American TV, yet here I am surrounded by a billionaire Italian playboy, a corrupt British politician, and an American PR guru who sold himself out to become another corrupt British politician's right-hand man. This is a symptom of the wider problem. Our national leadership is so weak that our voice has no hope of being heard inside a bloated supranational organization like the GSC. Let alone an organization led by someone as rabidly anti-American as Chairman Godfrey. Godfrey sighed and rolled his eyes, successfully masking the smug grin which momentarily crossed his lips. Despite what Crabbe seemed to think, he liked the Chairman Godfrey address. He knew it sounded Maoist to some and ridiculous to others, which was why Crabbe said it with such derision, but to Godfrey it was a powerful prefix suitable for a man of his position. And just as importantly, it was his alone. Marion de Klerk interjected, as she sometimes did when conversation drifted off topic, pointing out to Crabbe that there were no British parliamentarians on the panel. "Chairman Godfrey is here in his position as head of the Global Space Commission," she said, "while Jack Neal was invited primarily in his capacity as a former high-profile advisor to President Slater, who was unable to accept our invitation to join the panel due to the understandably intense demands on her time."
"Precisely," Godfrey nodded, expressing gratitude for the clarification. "And as for the laughable personal accusation of anti-American bias..."
This time Joe Crabbe interrupted. "People talk about a GSC cover-up," he said, pounding the desk and getting into his flow, "but they aren't even thinking about what could be going on behind the curtain. We all know how disappointed I was in my old friend Richard Walker when it came to pass that he really had been covering up the existence of alien life. But what I want us all to reflect on now is that the past year has absolved Richard of everything. On Crabshoot Radio, he spoke of apocalyptic politics and a toxic agenda of unification among the Eurocrats driving for a one-world government. Do you all remember that? And when our discussion turned to how we could best protect ourselves from spaceborne threats, Richard said, 'We do it ourselves, or we don't do it at all, or otherwise the aliens would be the least of our worries.' Ladies and gentlemen, when I point to this man, this creature, who calls himself Chairman Godfrey, I don't think I have to say any more. The globalists have already castrated our National Space Agency and every other country's to boot. If you don't think our national militaries are next, you're not paying attention." As Crabbe's aggressively delivered words echoed in the studio, de Klerk held a hand towards Godfrey to invite his response.
"Well, for those of us in the real world," he began with a barely disguised chuckle, "we are, of course, still waiting for Richard Walker to apologize for his indefensible decision to unilaterally hide the truth for so long. Joe, I imagine a lot of people would be more willing to listen to your viewpoints if you would take a few seconds to apologize on behalf of your old chum. If you had any decency, you certainly would. But then, as with Walker, I suppose decency would be a lot to expect for a man of your, what's the word, persuasion?"
"I have nothing to apologize for," Crabbe snapped. "And even if I did, I'll start swimming to the moon before I start apologizing to the likes of you. When your mouth opens, lies come out."
Marion de Klerk tapped her desk twice. "Now that we're all reacquainted, we have approximately 17 commercial-free minutes to discuss Fiori Frontieri, the future of space research, before moving on to our second topic, transparency at the GSC. Despite the closer-than-normal subject matter of our two preset topics, both of which may entail elements of a discussion around the Kerguelen bolide, I will enforce a division between the topics as far as possible. We'll begin now with some direct reactions to Timo's recent announcement of his plans to develop a private space program under the name Fiori Frontieri. Chairman Godfrey, I expect that you might have something to say on this."
"I know we're getting to Kerguelen," Godfrey said, "and I'll respect the division of topics by addressing my own organization's transparency in due course. But this Fiori Frontieri nonsense doesn't exist in a vacuum, and any discussion must begin with a word on the timing of his announcement. During a period of uncertainty over the nature of the event at Kerguelen, Mr. Fiori wasted no time in making grandiose promises of outcomes he'll never have to deliver, as is his way. Isn't it, Timo?" Someone with his level of influence should know that he has to be more responsible, but I suppose we shouldn't expect too much responsibility from a man who has never done an hour's work in his life and would rather waste his inherited fortune on ridiculous vanity projects than use it to alleviate poverty in the poorest regions of this planet he claims to care so much about.
Timo's expression gave little away in the face of Godfrey's verbal onslaught. Emma's practiced techniques for keeping a poker face were already paying off.
The Ark, the observatory. You know I can almost shrug my shoulders and say there's no harm in being ambitious, Godfrey went on. We will do those things in time, of that I'm sure. But reciprocity? A probe of that nature is nothing but a transparently colossal waste of money, and it simply cannot be justified when so many people are starving. Just like Voyager before it, 40,000 years for those golden records to reach the nearest star. This is nothing more than another back-slapping endeavor by an out-of-touch scientific elite and a slap in the face for those who do so much to stretch limited resources in their efforts to feed the hungry and house the poor.
Chairman Godfrey, Timo sighed, shaking his head slowly in disbelief, don't act like we don't know where you came from. Don't act like we don't know about the decades you've spent fighting to protect the advantages of your friends at the top.
Exactly, Jack Neal sycophantically jumped in.
And you can wipe the smirk off your face, too, Timo fired at him. No one has forgotten how willingly your man Cole sold out his voters and supported this shark's attempts to destroy the British Health Service last year.
Marion de Klerk cleared her throat. As I said, Timo, it's important that we keep to the correct topic. These kinds of political points don't belong in either of today's segments.
Point taken, Timo acknowledged. Sometimes a little background is necessary, that's all. But I will touch on Voyager since he mentioned it. Despite my view that certain things could and should have been done differently, it's important to remember that when we look at Voyager, we're looking decades into the past with the benefit of hindsight. It's also important to remember that the golden records themselves were very inexpensive in relation to the cost of that mission as a whole, which everyone with the slightest interest in space knows has provided us with mountains of priceless data and imagery. So I wholeheartedly disagree with Chairman Godfrey's comment, and I stand firm in my belief that we should always do the best we can with the resources available to us at the time.
Waste of money then, waste of money now.
Godfrey muttered under his breath. And there it is again, Timo said, pointing his finger at Godfrey. On the broader point of reciprocity's cost, I want to stress that my proposals are the polar opposite of the GSC's research model. By that I mean that rather than allocating public money to companies aiming to develop proprietary technologies, at Fiori Frontieri, we will privately fund the research and development of projects which will benefit the public. Secondly, this kind of thing is propaganda, plain and simple. Pre-GSC, I had a lot of friends in the Indian space sector, and whenever they launched or even announced anything, the news reported in the West would unfailingly include a few lines about poverty rates in India. You know, just to remind us of the pecking order. But whenever NASA launched something in Florida, did the European press talk about homelessness rates in the U.S., which are higher than those in India? Of course not. You see, there's a powerful agenda working to maintain the status quo. Unfortunately for that status quo's current beneficiaries, I'm not going to put up with it any longer. Godfrey made a show of rolling his eyes at Timo's reply.
And very briefly, de Klerk said, it would be remiss of me not to at least touch on the social media storm surrounding some of your recent comments, Timo.
He knew this question had been coming, and Emma's lines were fresh in his mind. Well, there was no storm. But I do know what you're talking about, so I'll say this once. I have all the time in the world for genuine struggles for the dignity of minority groups of all kinds. What I have no time for is the clickbait media's shameless tactic of drumming up hysteria and manufacturing outrage where no real offense has been taken, much less intended.
And would you like to take this opportunity to apologize?
De Klerk asked in a neutral tone. Timo made sure to sit up straight and hold his chin high.
No. No one was surprised when Jack Neal again jumped to Timo's defense just as unwelcomely as the last time.
Personally, I want to applaud you for standing up to the censorious thought police who have tried to derail your reciprocity initiative, Jack said. And that's one position the Prime Minister definitely does agree with.
Timo shrugged.
Personally, Jack, I don't care what you think, and I don't want your support.
Jack's expression recoiled slightly at the unexpectedly fierce rebuke, but he glanced at his notes and continued anyway with a pre-written passage he clearly wanted to get across.
Well, since we've been talking about the Voyager Golden Records, I think it's worth pointing out that the massive technological advancements since the 1970s mean that being representative should be infinitely easier today than it was back then, when they did a great job in difficult circumstances. Logistically speaking, it's much easier now that everything required can be gathered with a click of a mouse, rather than an intercontinental flight and a visit to a distant library. But sociologically speaking, it's now become literally impossible to be sufficiently representative. As Timo has seen, it doesn't matter what you say, what you mean, or even what you do. It's more difficult than ever due to the new and overwhelming need for tokenistic inclusion of everyone and everything, no matter the broader relevance or lack thereof. That's all I want to say on that.
Good, Godfrey chimed in, because you're boring us all to tears.
Timo clenched his teeth to avoid grinning automatically at Godfrey's put-down. Like every other piece of advice from Emma, this one worked too. My own last word on this is that reciprocity is far from the most important thing we're working on, he said. But I do firmly believe that attempting to capture a snapshot of human civilization in a message for our extraterrestrial friends is a worthwhile endeavor. And in case I need to make this any clearer than it already is, I won't allow the project to be hijacked by Jack Neal's shallow and predictable rhetoric.
William Godfrey grinned from ear to ear. There was no clenching of teeth at his part of the desk. Then, with undeniably impressive ease, his expression turned suddenly serious.
But moving on, he said, firmly taking charge of the discussion as Marion de Klerk opted to let things flow. The Global Space Commission has been criticized in recent days for being too quiet. To that charge, I say this. At the GSC, we devote a great deal of our resources to issues of planetary defense. Just because we don't hold self-serving press conferences every few days, that doesn't mean we're not working tirelessly on threat analysis, on research and design, and on all manner of emergency protocols. An effective public agency is one that does its job well, and one that does its job quietly. I understand that for a publicity hound such as Mr. Fiori, particularly one who turns up for a serious discussion with the likes of Emma Ford at his side, the concept of taking pride in a job well done with quiet humility may be entirely alien, for want of a better word. But for some of us, our public duty is more important than our public image. And even if we collectively decide that it makes sense to actively send messages into space, why should they be physical messages targeted to a specific destination? Well-spread signals make far more sense.
You couldn't be more wrong about spreading the signals, Billy Kendrick interjected. His voice resonated through the studio as the other panelists turned to face the giant screen which showed his face. You're talking about whispering in the vague direction of every house in the neighborhood and hoping someone hears you. Timo is talking about knocking down the door of the one house we have reason to believe is occupied.
Why one house? Godfrey retorted. Yes, we know of one alien race, but for all we know, there could be dozens. The GSC has no official collective position on this, and nor should it on any speculative matters. But my personal belief is that the universe is likely to be teeming with truly Earth-like planets which host complex life.
The giant screen relayed Billy Kendrick, shaking his head.
I know that the scientific elite you pretend not to be part of likes to rabbit on about how unspectacular our planet is, Chairman Godfrey, but to them I say this. Earth is an unspectacular ball of rock in the same way that the Amazon rainforest is an unspectacular collection of trees. An almost impossible convergence of favorable conditions allows for the incredible biodiversity within that particular ecosystem, just as it does across our extraordinary planet as a whole. And I think I heard the weakest word in the world in there, too. Earth-like. What does that even mean? A golf ball is pretty damn egg-like from where I'm sitting, but only one of them has an embryo developing inside it. And it doesn't matter how many egg-like golf balls you find. If you want a bird, you need an egg.
Jack Neal, surprising some, visibly agreed with Billy.
And let's not forget that intelligence is rare even on Earth, he said.
A harsh observer may have quipped that this was the first intelligent thing Jack had said all day. Think about it. Look at the number of species, for one thing, yet only one has ascended to any real level of technological development. And it goes further. Within our incredible species, look at the number of civilizations which have risen and fallen throughout history. But how many ever came close to achieving space travel? Chairman Godfrey seems to be falling back on the old Copernican principle of mediocrity, which is no surprise given how many people today view humanity itself as mediocre. I can't exactly blame them either, because all of us have been browbeaten from infancy to view humanity as bad. Particularly here in the West, we've been shamed since youth with ideologically driven teachings that our forefathers were somehow uniquely evil, that they were and that we are bad, and that our very existence is something to be ashamed of. As within any worldview built around a concept of original sin, it is therefore perfectly understandable for us to cling to a belief that there is, that there must be, something out there that's better than us. From there, it's no great leap to expect there to be many things better than us. But I'm with Billy on this one. Every instance of life in this universe is a miracle. And to my mind, the proven existence of one other intelligent race does not increase the likelihood that there may be a third, much less multiple others. Right is right, Billy said, apparently less insistent than Timo on distancing himself from Jack. And for once, the idiot is right. Timo didn't have to hide his grin this time. He was certainly allowed to openly agree with Billy. That's enough of that, Mr. Kendrick, de Klerk admonished him. Please refrain from the insults. Billy held his hands up so close to his camera that they filled the studio's giant screen. My apologies, but if I can shift things along to Kerguelen, I want to make the point directly to Godfrey that... Chairman Godfrey, he butted in. I want to ask Godfrey why no official data regarding the bolide has been made public in the 4 days since it occurred. Billy continued, unperturbed by the interruption. I was one of very few people who saw that meteor's entry and explosion with my own eyes, and I know that it was a spectacular event worthy of the world's attention, but we've heard nothing official from Buenos Aires, not a peep. Godfrey and his cronies want this story to go away, and I want to know why. What are you hiding? Godfrey feigned exasperation. What do you want me to tell you, Billy? That it was a spaceship disguised as a meteor and that the aliens are currently being interrogated on Kerguelen? Here comes the laughter curtain, Billy said, right on cue, but I've got some bad news for you, Godfrey. It didn't work for Walker on Dan McCarthy, and it doesn't work for you on this. No, 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 Godfrey said. Listen, Billy, I'm not Richard Walker, and I hate to break this to you, but you're certainly not Dan McCarthy. You're a hack and a charlatan who never met a spotlight he didn't like. I understand that you have books and tools to sell, but you have to understand that I have a planet to keep safe. Your tiresome paranoia and your pathological need to frame every temporary mystery as a deliberate conspiracy are not healthy for anyone. The best scientists in the world have studied and analyzed all available data, and among the many smart people I trust very much, the consensus is that the bolide was nothing out of the ordinary and poses no reason for alarm. First the laughter curtain and now the C-word? Billy said, grinning through the words. Wow, if I didn't already know you were hiding something, I sure as hell would now. Before I explain that, I want to encourage everyone out there to retain and utilize their own logical faculties through all of this. Don't just listen to the established authorities or any other predominant figures, including myself. Get to the point, Billy. Godfrey sighed. As you wish. But let me tell you this, when you try to substantiate an idea by throwing the word consensus at anyone who disagrees with it, I'm not just skeptical of your assertion, I'm suspicious of your motive. Facts are facts and evidence is evidence, and if yours were as convincing as you pretend they are, then you wouldn't need to do this. If the data and facts could stand on their own 2 feet, you would let them. I don't care how many of your people share the same interpretation of the data. I want to see the data. I fully agree, Jack Neal said. Wisely, Billy ignored Jack altogether. There is an agenda at play when it comes to what data is allowed to become public, but this is deeper than that, he continued. To put it simply, we have lost our humility. We as a culture have come to believe two very dangerous things. Our first dangerous belief is that we know everything there is to know, and our second, even more dangerous belief, is that everything we know is correct. Across all disciplines, we have lost our desire for discovery and discarded it in favor of a craving for confirmation. That's why today, whenever any kind of intellectually challenging discovery or dogma-smashing breakthrough is posited, people like Godfrey shout it down for daring to question the consensus. These are the hallmarks of a civilization in decline, and it's important that we catch them before they get away from us. As everyone turned to Marion de Klerk to see who would be invited to respond first to Billy's impassioned comments, Focus 2020's well-respected host shifted in her chair and looked down at the unseen tablet computer built into her desk. With less than a minute remaining in our first segment, I've just been alerted to a truly extraordinary development, she said. I'm told that the document you're all about to see has been verified by several extremely senior GSC employees, and the network has clearly seen sufficient evidence to feel confident in encouraging me to air this. Mr. Kendrick, your feed will temporarily disappear from the screen as I show this document to our panelists, but your voice will still be heard. You will see the document too. Interesting, Billy said. So without further ado, de Klerk announced. She then tapped a menu option to initiate the change on the giant screen. Sure enough, Billy disappeared. In one sense, that was a shame, because the document that took his place raised an incredulous smile on his face that could have become an iconic reaction image. In the studio, William Godfrey tried to hide a scowl as he looked immediately and instinctively towards Timo Fiori. Timo likewise tried to hide a grin as wide as Billy's. As you should now be able to see, de Klerk addressed the viewers at home, a leaked memo from the GSC's headquarters has come into our possession, and as you can imagine, the second part of today's panel will now focus squarely on its content. Join us after these short messages for what is sure to be our most explosive segment ever. I knew it, Billy's voice rang through the studio. He then quoted the leaked document in a mocking newsreader-like tone. It is our belief that the Kerguelen event was not just highly irregular, but observably unnatural. Game over, Godfrey. The GSC leak is out. Timo glanced across the desk at Godfrey and winked in victory. One Emma Ford was all he needed. C-51. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. 1,800 miles from New York, Dan McCarthy sat in the same kind of speechless shock as the Focus 2020 panelists who had just learned that William Godfrey had indeed been covering up data-informed suspicions that the Kerguelen bolide was an unnatural event. That something about the bolide wasn't natural came as no surprise to Dan. Thanks to the painful jolt in his neck during the event, he had known that something unnatural was going on before he even knew what it was. It did surprise him that GSC researchers had seen enough to voice their controversial scientific opinions, and it amazed him that their collectively signed memo had now become public, despite Godfrey's best efforts to suppress it. If Dan could have changed anything, he would have changed Focus 2020's rules to allow Timo and Emma to talk strategy backstage during the commercial break. If he had known that Emma and Timo had set the leak in motion with some help from Alessandro Bonucci and Dan's other old friends in Timo's Italian observatory, he wouldn't have worried about this. During a short commercial break in which Henry said very little, a point Dan didn't mind, given his desire to avoid any conversations that could lead to an accidental slip of the tongue, Clark finally arrived home from his overtime session at the precinct. He walked in wearing his police uniform and with a brown briefcase in his hand. Dan had barely ever seen Clark holding so much as a pen, let alone a briefcase, and if his mind hadn't been otherwise occupied, he would likely have laughed and made a quip about how he looked like a gorilla dressed up as a police officer on the first day of his new job in the big city. "How are you guys doing?" Clark asked. Still annoyed at Dan for telling Timo without clearing it with him and Emma, he looked only at Henry despite addressing the question to both of them. "Not bad," Henry said. "This thing is getting more exciting than I thought it would be." Clark looked at the TV, still airing ads, then to the clock on the wall. "Shit, I didn't even realize the time. I'll grab a drink and you guys can catch me up on what's happened so far." "Someone at the GSC leaked a memo about Kerguelen," Henry said, seeing no sense in waiting until Clark was back from the kitchen. "Apparently they have data that makes them think the bolide wasn't a natural event, and apparently Godfrey has been actively trying to cover it up. Looks like Kendrick was right.
Who'd have thought it, huh?
Clark emerged from the kitchen with no drink in his hand, staring at Dan to try to read his mood without saying anything in front of Henry. In the absence of any knowledge of actual sign language, Dan resorted to the clearest gestures he could think of. First, he pointed to an imaginary watch on his wrist and quickly held up two fingers, followed by a circle shape for 0. 20 minutes. He then pointed to the basement before making a talking sign with his hand. We need to talk. Clark shrugged with palms as well as shoulders, then mouthed the word, why? As subtly as he could, Dan put his hands together in a sleep sign beside his head, then tapped the back of his neck. This wasn't accurate in the strictest sense. This time he had been summoned to the cornfield in his sleep without having felt any jolts in his neck, but it got the point across. After standing with his wide eyes for several seconds, Clark held out his right hand with the thumb outstretched, alternating between a thumbs up and thumbs down. Dan gave a thumbs up. Clark went back into the kitchen and quickly returned to the couch with beers for him and Henry and a giant energy drink for Dan. His anger over the Timo incident seemed to have faded, for now at least, and Dan was glad to see it.
Okay,